You are listening to We Saw the Devil, an investigative and conversational true crime podcast that deep dives into fascinating criminal cases that are solved, unsolved, or ongoing. From America's Lori Vallow to Germany's Armin Mivas, we examine and discuss the world's most shocking cases. If you're enjoying the show, don't forget to follow us online. Check us out at WeSawTheDevil.com and WeSawTheDevil on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, you can become part of the show by backing us on Patreon. Hello, everyone. You are listening to We Saw the Devil. This is Robin, and I am here with an updated Pam Hupp series, guys. As all of you know, the most recent episode this week was with Russ Faria's criminal defense attorney, Joel Schwartz. So the last episode was my interview with him. And back a couple months ago, it's about a year ago, I actually covered the whole Pam Hupp case, which is how I actually got in contact with Joel. I covered the whole case in a 5-part series. And after the Joel Schwartz interview, a lot of you wanted to go back and listen. Well, I thought instead of, 5 separate episodes on this case, how about we put them together? So that is what this episode is. I lumped them together. It's going to be a 2-part series. Instead of 5, it's just going to be 2 pieces, putting these episodes back together. First, let's get our quick housekeeping out of the way. You are listening to We Saw the Devil. I'm Robin. You can find our website at WeSawTheDevil.com. And from there, you can find us all across social media, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and so forth. You can also find us if you're digging the show and you want to financially back it. You can do so at our Patreon, which is at patreon.com/WeSawTheDevil. For as little as $3 a month, you can support the show, get stuff like stickers, postcards, swag, depending on your support level. And executive producers, which is $25 and up, get a t-shirt and the ability to come on the show, like cover a topic, cover their favorite case, and come on the show. But let's go ahead and get into today's episode. On Tuesday, December 27th, 2011, Russ Faria called 911 to report that he had just discovered that his wife, 42-year-old Betsy Faria, had killed herself. As you just heard from the 911 call, Russ was in hysterics, crying, unable to breathe. He called 911 expecting police and EMS to come to his aid. What he wasn't expecting was that no one who arrived on scene that night would believe that Betsy Faria had committed suicide. They believed that her 55 stab wounds told a different story. And this belief, this version of events, would lead to more than 10 years of absolute hell for Russ Faria. This is quite possibly the craziest case I have ever heard. And Hollywood apparently agrees because Renee Zellweger was cast as the lead for the upcoming TV series based on this case. It's actually coming out in 2 weeks on March 8th. When we think of evil, manipulative women, a few immediately come to our minds, right? We have Jodi Arias, Casey Anthony, Eileen Wuornos, and more recently, Lori Vallow. By the end of this episode, you will have another name to add to this list, Pamela Hupp. Pamela Newman was born on October 10, 1958 in Delman, Missouri, in a devout Catholic home. Her mom was a school teacher working at a local school, and her father was a longtime employee for Union Electric, happily backed by the union. It was a wonderful childhood. Pam was known as being kind, vivacious, and playful. Beautiful, with long, flowing blonde hair and an infectious laugh. It was hard not to like her. She had many friends, and they rode their bikes around the neighborhood almost daily. For high school, she attended Riverview Gardens in St. Louis. She was popular and a member of the cheerleading squad. And if you ask any of her former classmates what they remember about Pam, they all say one of 3 things. She wasn't that great at school, she loved to party, and she was 100% boy crazy. Her popularity allowed her to frequently date, but she began to go steady with an attractive, soft-spoken boy who was a star athlete, exceptional student, and member of the National Honor Society. A couple weeks after going to their senior prom together, a pregnancy test confirmed Pam's fears. She was pregnant. Most likely, due to her stringent Catholic upbringing, she knew it had to happen. She and Mark had to get married. Resenting the fact that her friends were enjoying college life, Pam sat at home in a dingy apartment with her daughter while her husband worked long hours to provide for their small family. The resentment grew to be too much, and the marriage dissolved after only 6 years. Soon after the divorce, Pam met Mark Hupp. He was attractive, also soft-spoken, and played minor league baseball for the Texas Rangers. The two became almost immediately enamored with each other and married rather quickly. Mark ended up not being drafted by the major league, so he became a carpenter. The pair soon welcomed a baby boy and moved to Florida in 1989. Not finding a great deal of happiness or success in Florida, they moved back to Missouri, buying a home in the city of O'Fallon. With Mark's carpentry skills and a plump savings account, the two began to flip houses in the area. Needing steady income with a regular paycheck, Pam went to work at a local state farm office. Betsy Faria was the very first person who greeted her. 32-year-old Betsy was the kind of woman that everyone loved, and her plethora of friends made that clear. She was always smiling and laughing, even if she herself was having a rough time. And as cliche as it is, she literally lit up the room with her good-hearted presence. She was a little overweight, with sparkly eyes, curly blonde hair, and she was the very definition of an extrovert. She moonlit as a DJ for hire, a side gig that perfectly suited her personality. She was married to Russell Faria, and the two were very much in love. Russ reminds you almost of a Detective Bautista from Dexter, heavyset guy with dark hair, bright eyes, and a style that includes that trademark fedora. Both had been married one time before, and the couple had two daughters from Betsy's previous marriage. Betsy had convinced Russ to go back to school, and he was able to get a good IT job at Enterprise Holdings. By all accounts, the family appeared to be very happy. 11 years older than Betsy, Pam was the exact opposite. She was quiet and even-natured. That isn't to say that her coworkers didn't like her. They did. It's just that her personality was that of the office matriarch, emotionally mature, a good listener, and someone who would offer honest advice if asked. Betsy and Pam became fast friends, often going to dinner or even going shopping together. However, cracks started to appear at work. Pam was caught forging her manager's signature on an insurance claim. Mysteriously, cars in the small State Farm office parking lot started to get keyed. Nasty anonymous notes were left on windshields. Likewise, the same started happening in the neighborhood that Pam and Mark Hupp had just moved into. Whether or not there was a connection, no one was able to officially determine. Pam eventually left State Farm and then job hopped for a while, repeatedly getting fired after being caught doing multiple forgeries, and she actually stopped working altogether. She and Betsy Faria completely lost touch, and the two went their separate ways. By 2010, Pam was on Social Security disability, citing neck, back, and leg pain. During this time, Betsy and Russell Faria were also having their share of ups and downs. Betsy's health was a roller coaster, and she and Russell would frequently squabble over money. Russell was an easygoing guy, but really liked hanging out with his male friends after work, and by all accounts, he wasn't necessarily that involved with his stepdaughters. Russ and Betsy had multiple very aggressive fights, and on at least one occasion, Betsy did try to commit suicide. Things took a turn for the worst when, in 2010, after some testing, Betsy was diagnosed with breast cancer. It was pretty advanced. Devastated and distraught by the news, Betsy and Russ came together in a united front and decided to weather the storm together. Somehow, Pam and Betsy ended up reconnecting during this time, and they were nearly inseparable almost immediately. Pam would accompany Betsy to her treatments and bring her food and run some errands for her. Russ still had to work full-time, so he was thankful for the help. After a long series of treatments, it looked like Betsy was going to beat her breast cancer. Russ was secretly planning a celebration of life cruise for his wife, and Betsy had always wanted to go on a cruise. One of her biggest life dreams was to swim with dolphins. Russ made all of this happen, and the cruise was scheduled to take place in November of 2011. A month before she was scheduled to embark on the tropical cruise, in October of 2011, Betsy received more devastating news. The cancer had metastasized and spread to her liver. It was terminal, and she was going to die. She and Russ went on the cruise anyway, as now it took an even deeper meaning. Upon her return, Pam Hupp was immediately right back in the picture, taking Betsy to every single appointment at the local hospital. watching her play tennis, visiting Betsy's father, helping her with errands and things around the house. Betsy's own family found this curious. The month following the cruise, on December 22, 2011, the two women were walking a local neighborhood looking for donations for their cancer fundraiser for a local family. Selfless to the end, Betsy wanted it to be her legacy. They decided to make a side trip to the local library. After using the printer, Betsy Faria and Pam Huck walked up to a young librarian at the counter and asked her to be a witness to a signature. The document? A beneficiary change for Betsy Faria's life insurance. You see, Betsy was becoming concerned for the financial stability of her family after she passed. Russ, as much as she loved him, wasn't really known for being the most responsible when it came to family finances. This sentiment was furthered when Betsy's father had set her down and expressed his concerns that Russ and her daughters would, quote, piss away the money. Tuesday, December 27th, 2011, just 4 days after Betsy had changed the beneficiary of her life insurance policy from her husband Russ Faria to Pam Hupp. The day began like any other. Russ and Betsy woke up and Russ departed for work. Betsy had a cancer treatment appointment that day at the Siteman Cancer Center in St. Peter's. She traveled to her mother's apartment and her mother's friend Bobby planned to take her to that appointment. Pam Hupp texted Betsy's mom and received the reply that the appointment was all taken care of. A long-missed family friend was going to do it so she and Betsy could spend some quality time together. Imagine the surprise then when Pam Hupp showed up at the hospital uninvited and sat down between Betsy and Bobby. She later claimed that she had not gotten the text from Betsy's mom saying that they had had plans. This was a lie. As Pam's phone record showed, she actually replied, "Bummer." Pam departed and went back home to Fallon to eat a quick dinner with her husband. She then turned around and drove back to Betsy's mom's apartment to pick Betsy up and drop her off at her home. Now, Tuesday nights were Russell Faria's personal nights. He would eat dinner with his mom and then usually go over to a friend's house where he and four or five other guys would drink beer, smoke a little pot, and play board games like Talisman or Settlers of Catan. This evening, he worked from home until 5, grabbed gas, and at 5:22, phoned his mother to let her know that he would not be able to drop by for dinner. At 5:56, he stopped at a local market and bought two bottles of Snapple tea and a bag of dog food that he promised Betsy he would pick up, and then he arrived at his friend's house at 6 p.m. At this time, Betsy Faria is at Pam Hupp's house. They depart Pam's house as she was giving Betsy a ride back to her home in Troy. At 7 p.m., Betsy's daughter calls regarding a cell phone purchase. A few minutes later, a little after 7 p.m., Betsy and Hupp arrive at Betsy's house. Pam claimed that the lights were off and the door was unlocked. At 7:04 p.m., Pam Hupp called her husband Mark to tell him that they had made it safely and she would be leaving soon. Over the next 20 minutes, 7:21, 7:26, and at 7:30, Betsy's daughter called her mom 3 times, but she never received an answer. Pam Hupp's cell phone record showed that she was still in the immediate area as of 7:27. During this time, Russ drank and smoked with his friends and watched a movie and a half. Around 9 p.m., he decided to head home. Russ stopped at an Arby's for a late dinner with a receipt showing 9:09 p.m. He then drove the 24.6 miles home. He walked through the garage door into the kitchen and saw Betsy covered in blood on the living room floor. Blood had soaked through her clothes and pooled around her. One wrist was slashed open. And the handle of one of the black-handled, serrated-edge Master Chef kitchen knives was sticking out of her neck. Betsy had made multiple suicide attempts in her life and even written out lengthy suicide notes. Russ believed, before it all registered, that she had finally killed herself. He thought that the terminal cancer diagnosis had finally been enough to push her over the edge. He picked up his phone at exactly 9:40 and called 911. Immediately upon arrival, just 10 minutes later, first responders could tell 2 things. First, that this was not a suicide. Secondly, that Betsy had been dead for a while. One medic described the body as cold and stiff. Betsy's wrists weren't just slashed. The knife had gone all the way down to the bone with a great deal of force. The knife sticking out of her neck was so deep that it burst her right carotid artery. And those weren't the only wounds. Russ couldn't see them at the time through all the blood on Betsy's clothes, but she had been stabbed 55 times. Liver, lung, and spleen perforations. Once through her left eye, and once in her skull with a thrust so deep that it fractured it. As EMS personnel began to leave the home, detectives and investigative teams arrived. Russ was taken to a police cruiser and engaged in benign conversation with the officer. At times, he would converse normally, like nothing had even happened, especially not finding his wife of more than 15 years butchered in his living room. Other times, he would suddenly hyperventilate and sob uncontrollably. This behavior, as well as the lack of actual wet tears, was marked by police as highly suspicious. While Russ was talking to the officer outside, a detective made a solemn discovery in a closet in the living room. A pair of men's slippers, splattered with blood. The light switch plate nearby was also dripping with blood. Russ was taken into custody by the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office. He knew that, as the husband, he would be suspect number one. He was interrogated for more than 10 hours, and all of it was recorded. As detectives counted the stab wounds and relayed them back to him, he vehemently denied being responsible for Betsy's murder. But again, his behavior threw investigators. When left alone in the room, Russ would sob hysterically, pray, or say Betsy's name over and over and over again. When they entered and began to ask him questions, all emotions and outbursts stopped. The next morning, Russ was given a polygraph test, and he failed it. At this point, detectives believed that they had their man. Husband killed wife who was dying of cancer. Blood was found on his slippers and on the light switch plate leading into the closet. But there was no blood on him. Not a single drop, a speck, nor any evidence of Russ having taken a shower to clean himself up. Likewise, there was no attempt at a scene cleanup, and no blood was found in the bathroom tub drain. The same day, another person had received a phone call. Pam Hupp. Because she was the last to see Betsy alive, they wanted to know what she had witnessed and observed. Pam told investigators that Betsy had wanted to move closer to her mom in the cancer treatment center. It was over an hour drive, which would have made Russ's commute to work a nightmare. She said that Betsy was going to bring it up at dinner with him that night, but was fearful because he had a nasty temper. Being the ever-loving and supportive friend, Pam said that she felt guilty for leaving Betsy there to confront Russ alone. Major case squad investigators for the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office scheduled a polygraph exam for Pam Hupp 3 days after the murder. But Pam Hupp had already lawyered up. Her lawyer asked to postpone the test until he could be there with her in person. Shortly thereafter, police received a letter from a Dr. Ronald Fisher of St. Luke's Medical Group. Dr. Fisher's letter said that Pam was, quote, unable to undergo a polygraph due to her medical condition. Investigators were told that Pam Hupp had a past head injury, was on medication, and possibly prone to seizures. Attached to Dr. Fisher's letter was a note that Pam had sent him herself. She requested that Dr. Fisher write a letter, quote, stating that I am not able to do my polygraph due to medical reasons. Don't need to be any more detailed than that. That polygraph test was never done. Pam did discuss the life insurance policy with investigators, though, and they were aware that Betsy had just changed the beneficiary to Pam Hupp only 5 days before her death. But beyond a physical exam that included swabs from her face, hands, and body for cuts and bruises, and verifying Pam's GPS coordinates that night, Pam was never a suspect. Investigators never truly investigated her. She seemingly went out of her way to prove her own innocence, even calling police a few days after the murder to let them know that they could go through her trash contents before it was packed up on the curb. A few days later, on January 4th, Russ was officially arrested and charged with first-degree murder and armed criminal action. 2 years later, on November 8th of 2013, the case went to trial. It was seemingly an uphill battle for prosecutor Leah Askey. Investigators for the prosecution could not figure out exactly when Russ could have killed Betsy. Eventually, they landed on two different theories. Before or after his stop at Arby's. Now, keep this in mind. All four of Russ Faria's friends provided him with an alibi, maintaining that he had been with them since 6 p.m. that evening. They testify that he had left the home at exactly 9 p.m. The Arby's receipt clocked in at 9.09 p.m. Just 9 minutes later. There was no blood on Russ whatsoever and no evidence of an attempt at scrubbing up the scene or cleaning it. The only piece of evidence was the pair of blood-soaked slippers in the closet that Russ Faria claimed must have been planted by the actual killer. Joel Schwartz, Russ's attorney, truly believed in his client's innocence from the very beginning. The timeline just did not add up. He knew this, which is why he made a request to the judge presiding over the case, Judge Chris Kunze-Minnemeyer, to make the prosecutor settle on a single theory as to how Russ committed the murders. He, you know, you can't really go into a murder trial and say, don't know how he did it, but we know he did it, and he did it one of eight ways. Joel Schwartz's request for that was rejected. Schwartz would go on to say that this allowed the prosecuting attorney to, quote, improperly argue the existence of imaginary facts in closing arguments because she told jurors that the four alibi witnesses may have been accomplices who helped Faria hide his wife's murder. The prosecution also insinuated that the reason why Russ was seen on so many CCTV cameras is because he was trying to be seen. So why didn't Russ have a single drop of blood on his body? Why were his clothes, which were captured in CCTV footage at various stops, why was it all clean? Well, the prosecution had an answer for that as well. He may have taken his clothes off when he got home, killed Betsy while naked, and then put his dirty clothes back on. Prosecutor Askey made these claims in her closing statements of the trial. The defense had no opportunity to make a rebuttal or present forensic findings. That should have planted plenty of seeds of doubt early on, and according to jurors who were later interviewed, it did. But then there was the star witness of the prosecution, Pam Hupp. Pam testified that she and Betsy had been best friends for 10 years and that Russ Faria was a heavy drinker who verbally and physically abused Betsy. She claimed that he constantly degraded her. She said that Betsy was terrified of her husband and never wanted to return home. She claimed that Betsy had confided in her that Russ once held a pillow over her face and partially suffocated her, saying that that's what it would feel like when she died. Pam also said that Betsy had lots of affairs with other men. Pam claimed the night of Betsy's murder, Betsy was going to tell Russ that she was going to leave him and move in with her family, and she was scared of how he was going to react. Most of Betsy's other friends and family testified the exact opposite, that Russ was a loving, doting husband, father, family man. Pam Hupp was more convincing than Betsy's own family. Couple that with the fact that one of Betsy Faria's friends from church, Sondra McClanahan, said she was, quote, uncomfortable around Russ and found him rude and derogatory about their Christian religion, the narrative stuck. Both sides were aware that Pam Hupp had become the sole beneficiary to Betsy Faria's $150,000 life insurance policy. But that fact never made it to trial. The defense tried to get it introduced, but the prosecution objected, and the judge presiding over the trial agreed. You see, introducing the beneficiary change would have opened the case up to a new suspect and a new motive. Investigators knew this too. In fact, a major case squad detective who was prepping for the trial told Pam Hupp that it, quote, looked bad for her to be holding Betsy Faria's life insurance money. He said that she should put it in a trust fund for Betsy's daughters in order to look less suspicious. Court records show that Pam Hupp created a revocable trust for Betsy's daughters on November 13, 2013. And Russ Faria's attorney, Joel Schwartz, noted multiple inconsistencies between Hupp's initial police questioning and her testimony on the stand. He believed from the very beginning that she was responsible for Betsy Faria's murder and even told the prosecution that they had a case, just not against his client Russ. Joel Schwartz was the only one who believed in Russ Faria. Betsy's own family believed that Russ had killed her. As soon as they discovered that Betsy had changed the beneficiary over to Pam Hupp, they believed that Russ had killed her in anger. Police immediately believed him to be guilty due to his sporadic behavior and demeanor, and the prosecution had also doubled down on the tabletop games that Russ had been playing, saying they showed Russ's dark-minded fantasies and death. The trial came to a close. The first round of jury deliberations brought a 6-6 split. The jurors actively discussed the possibility that Pam Hupp could be a suspect, considering the timing. One juror in particular, Timothy Gaynor, said no, that wouldn't be possible. Pam Hupp was collecting disability due to various knee, back, and leg pain and wouldn't be able to fight the larger Betsy. He, too, supported the prosecution's timeline theories. And one major thing. The jurors were never, at any point, made aware of the change of beneficiary in Betsy's life insurance policy. It took the jurors just 4 hours to return a guilty verdict. Russ Furry was convicted and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. After the verdict, defense attorney Schwartz filed a motion for acquittal based on the grounds that the judge had denied 3 mistrial motions and prosecutors had failed to turn over some evidence. The prosecution also violated court orders restricting what they could say in closing arguments and brought up random facts and theories that were not based on evidence. Schwartz said the judge prevented a, quote, possible defense that someone else committed this crime, and that stripped Faria of his right to a full cross-examination of Hupp. Remember, Pam Hupp only testified for the state on the stand. She was never cross-examined by defense. This motion for acquittal was denied, and Russ Faria was moved to prison. Russ Faria would spend the next 2 years of his life in prison, and Joel Schwartz would continue to file appeals on his behalf. On the outside, Betsy's daughters were wondering what had happened to her mom's life insurance money. Where was that trust fund that Pam Hupp was supposed to create for them? They were now of age, so where was that money? And just to recap, here's the timeline of that. Pam Hupp created a revocable trust for Betsy's daughters on November 13th, 2013, just 5 days after the start of Russ Faria's trial. Russ Faria was convicted on November 21st. Pam revoked the trust fund on December 10th, 2013, just 2.5 weeks after he was convicted. Pam Hupp claimed and testified that she had earmarked $50,000 of the life insurance money for a friend of hers and Betsy's who was fighting cancer but then died. She claimed that she had $50,000 in her bank account, and all Betsy's daughters had to do is reach out to her. They tried, many times, but to no avail. And this was in December of 2013. During this time, Russ Faria was in prison, and he did multiple interviews with the media, and he maintained the entire time that he did not kill his wife. When asked who he felt was responsible for Betsy's death, possibly Pam Hupp, Russ replied, quote, I don't want to accuse anybody who may be innocent because I know how that feels. Something didn't quite feel right, and in January of 2014, just a month after Russ's conviction, Fox 2, KTVI, and the St. Louis Dispatch decided to collaborate and investigate the case from the very beginning. They pored through evidence, legal documents, and interviewed Russ in prison. They also spoke with his stepdaughters and discovered that Pam Hupp had never attempted to give them the money that she had promised. Chris Hayes of Fox 2 KTVI was the primary reporter behind this. While investigating, he uncovered multiple inconsistencies in Pam's statement to police and court testimony. First, Pam had told police multiple times that she had dropped Betsy off at her home and never went inside. This story changed multiple times and eventually shifted to her going inside and chatting briefly with Betsy before she departed. That was never introduced at the trial. Why? Maybe because KTVI and the St. Louis Dispatch also uncovered that the state's prosecuting attorney, Leah Askey, had been in a sexual relationship with Mike Lang, the captain of investigations for the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office. He was the chief investigating officer in the Betsy Faria murder case and had even testified against Russ at trial. Also, two members of the jury from Russ Faria's trial approached Fox 2 after they heard about their independent investigation. Ken Masterson and Debbie Bray sat down for an interview. Ken Masterson said, everybody there wanted to make the right decision. There was no one there that was like, oh, hell with you guys, he's guilty. Everybody there was willing to listen to everybody else. Bray agreed and then added, then we find out later things that we didn't get to hear. It's upsetting. I was very upset about it. You've got someone's life in your hands and you want to make sure you're making the right decision. The two explain that the prosecution never nailed down a time of death. The defense team had filed a motion to force the prosecution to pick a time frame, but the judge denied it. This, Masterson and Bray claimed, forced the jury to fill in the blanks themselves. Some jurors believed that Russ left his cell phone at his friend's house in order to go home and murder Betsy. Others believed that his alibi witnesses, the friends who he had been watching movies with that night, were suspicious. Their accounts just sounded too rehearsed. One of these men later in an interview with Fox 2 News said, quote, "I don't know what to say except for when you tell the truth, you don't have to remember a whole lot." Debbie Bray concluded the interview by saying, quote, "I hope he can get an appeal." Ken Masterson agreed, quote, "I hope that justice happens." Apparently, many of the jurors felt this way after hearing about evidence that had been excluded at that first trial. But not Betsy's family. Her sister, Mary Rogers, maintained that she was 100% sure that the right person was in prison. She testified against Russ and claimed that he was an abusive alcoholic who threatened Betsy multiple times. And don't forget that multiple officers who had arrived on scene the night of Betsy's murder, they found his behavior odd and at times emotionless. The emergency dispatch center supervisor, the boss of all 911 employees, testified at the trial that they felt Russ's call was odd. However, one person never made it to trial. Tammy Vaughn, the 911 dispatcher who actually took that call. After Russ was convicted, Tammy became very vocal about how she believed that he was genuine in his emotions. She said that Russ responded to the technique that 911 operators use, redirection. The dispatcher gives someone a set of tasks in order to calm them down and focus. She says it's very common for callers to shift back and forth with their emotions, from calm to outbursts, when their focus is placed back on the victim or injured person. Russ's defense attorney, Joel Schwartz, filed an appeal of the verdict, and on February 24, 2015, the Missouri Court of Appeals sent Russ Faria's case back to the 45th Judicial Court. The judge? Judge Chris Kunze-Mittemeyer. She was to oversee the hearing on a retrial motion. But then something unexpected happened. Circuit Court Judge Chris Kunze-Mittemeyer said that she had a, quote, "known conflict and must recuse," and asked for the case to be referred to another judge. And it was. The Missouri Supreme Court assigned Judge Rachel L. Bringer-Shepard to preside over the motion for a new murder trial. A hearing was held and a retrial was granted. Judge Stephen Omer was appointed to oversee the trial, which was scheduled for November 2nd, 2015. Remember the state prosecutor, Leah Askey? In a hearing, she called Russell and the defense's motion despicable. The trial began, and it would be a trial by judge, not jury. First up was the 911 call. Prosecutor Askey once again brought out witnesses who claimed that Russ was faking the tears and crying. This time, though, she also claimed that investigators had found a note on Betsy Faria's computer, saying that if anything happened to her, Russ was the culprit and that she feared for her life. Convenient that the note was discovered 3 years later, right before his retrial, right? Defense expert Greg Chatton showed evidence that the letter was planted. You see, it was created and saved on a Wi-Fi connection called The Club and was timestamped 5 days before the murder. Not only that, but it was created with Microsoft Word 97. But Word 97 wasn't installed and had never been installed on Betsy Faria's computer. In his testimony, Greg Chatton said, quote, "It would be impossible for that file to be created on that computer." Also on the first day, CSI agent Amy Butner, who was on the original major case squad of Greater St. Louis, testified. Under cross-examination, Butner contradicted several major points made by the prosecution in Russ's first trial. 1. The bloody slipper. There was no blood on the bottom of the slippers found in the closet off the living room near where Betsy Faria had died. It was on the side of them in, like, weirdly shaped drips. Butner testified that no one had stepped in blood and believed that the blood arrived on the shoes in a different manner. 2. No evidence of a crime scene cleanup. This will really get your blood boiling. This case is terrifying to me because it shows how easily corrupted our system can be, right? Agent Butner testified that the CSI team had not sprayed luminol the night of the murder because there was no evidence of an attempted cleanup. There was no evident blood on the cabinets, linoleum tiles, or a drainpipe. Remember, luminol is that chemical that shows blood that isn't detectable by the human eye. It's magical, then, that in Russ's first trial, police testified that there had been an attempt at cleaning up blood. Want to know why? Because the police sprayed luminol over the scene 5 days after Betsy's death, after her family had returned home and got cleaners to scrub the area. I'm not even freaking kidding. I wish I were. After this return visit 5 days later, they said they found evidence of blood and crime scene cleanup and introduced this evidence in Russ's first trial. But they didn't even have the photos and the photo evidence to back that up. 3. In the retrial, the defense showed 132 photos that were hidden by the prosecution during the first trial. Yeah, police investigators took 132 photos the night of Betsy Faria's murder, but because that did not fit their narrative, they hid these particular photos and did not show them in the original trial. They showed a clear lack of blood in any other area of the home. When asked by Judge Omer why they hadn't turned over the pictures, Leah Askey and the prosecution had no definitive answer. 4. The light switch near the closet. That light switch had blood on it. Butner testified that it appeared as though it had been transmitted there via cloth. No cloth was ever found at the scene. And lastly, in Russ's original trial, the prosecution made a huge deal of a bloody paw print from the family dog. Leah Askey, the prosecutor, had claimed that a bloody paw print on Betsy's body immediately meant that Russ was the killer. Agent Butner testified the exact opposite. There was no blood on the dog. Not only was there no blood on the family dog, but she had been explicitly forbidden to test for it. Again, the dog had never been tested for blood. So why was that falsified at Russ's first trial? And the beauty of this, the just sweet, sweet, delicious irony of this, is that Special Agent Amy Butner was a witness for the prosecution as she was giving this information and absolutely obliterating their case. Another forensics expert testified that upon examining the knife used in the murder, it was very apparent that the perpetrator had their hand covered. There was no palm print. In the first trial, the prosecution's expert claimed that Russ's bloody palm print was found on the knife. I mean, I'm sure you've already drawn this conclusion, but guys, there was no palm print. There was no trace of Russ Faria on that knife. And speaking of blood, the defense was actually finally able to bring forth new evidence, namely that Pam Hupp had become Betsy Faria's new life insurance beneficiary just days before her death. This was huge, the biggest piece of all of this. The defense was actually finally able to say, hey, here's another possible motive. And she was the last to see her alive and was there, like, basically right before she got murdered. State Farm had received the change in the mail 2 days after Betsy's murder. They were also able to present the discrepancies in Pam Hupp's testimony, because don't forget, her story on whether or not she entered Betsy Faria's house changed multiple times in one single interview. In her original investigation interview, Hupp told police that she was home by 7:27. Investigators determined that in actuality, her cell phone pinged near Betsy's home. In the trial, the defense's forensic expert produced a map of the cell phone activity for Pam Hupp and Russell and Betsy Faria. The defense had tried to introduce all of this evidence in Russ's first trial. If you recall, Joel Schwartz tried to include all of these different pieces of evidence, but the judge would not allow it. And in a new strange turn of events, police officers who testified at the retrial claimed that Pam Hupp had told them that she and Betsy Faria were lovers who had been carrying on a romantic and sexual affair for more than 10 years. Because that apparently wasn't enough, the prosecution trotted out Russ Faria's mistress as a witness, claiming that she had been pregnant with his child. Again, another motive. Did Russell kill Betsy to start a new life? The prosecution was quite literally taking spaghetti and flinging it at a wall and seeing what would stick. Now, Russ Faria did, in fact, have an affair with a woman named Carissa Barton. They had a one-month-long affair 1 year before Betsy's murder. However, Carissa Barton testified that she was never even pregnant with Russ's child and that she had lied to him after writing him a letter in prison. She herself was the one who ended the affair because Russ was happy with Betsy and she knew it wouldn't go anywhere. So the lie about her being pregnant was just a ploy to hurt him, and it totally blew up in the prosecution's face. And again, Russ Faria's four friends, whom he had been with the night of Betsy's murder, finally once again testified that he really was with them from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. All of this evidence was overwhelmingly in Russ's favor, and Judge Omer believed so as well. He acquitted Russ Faria of his wife's murder, and after 4 long years of complete hell, Russ Faria left the front door of the courthouse a free man. Prosecutor Leah fucking Askey published a statement in response. She said, quote, "While I believe in our justice system, I disagree with this verdict. My condolences go out to Betsy Faria's family." Now let's talk about Russ between 2015 and present day. A Facebook page that had been created for Russ during his struggle called Free Russ Faria now includes "updated, not guilty" at the end of its name. The page has remained open and active over the last 6 years, not only highlighting cases of other former prisoners who have been acquitted, but also following his wife's cold murder case, which is now, as of 2022, still an active investigation. You see, Russ's acquittal meant that he did not kill Betsy Faria. He didn't kill his wife. If you're like me and screaming, "What the hell happened to Pam Hupp? It's so freaking clear that she did it." Well, let's just say that Russ's acquittal made Pam Hupp very, very, very angry and desperate. Desperate and angry enough to be the reason for the series title, The Thing About Pam. Pam's story doesn't end at the acquittal. In fact, this acquittal is only just the beginning of Pam Hupp's story. And she was not even close to being finished with Russ Faria. There is some good news, though. In 2018, Leah Askey, now known as Cheney, she changed her name, lost her Republican primary to be Lincoln County prosecutor. The victor, Mike Wood, cited community disgust over the way that she handled Russ Faria's case as the chief reason why he won. Not only that, but she had been linked during the campaign to a whole host of misdeed and corruption. And don't forget, she was having an affair with Mike Lang, the captain of investigators for the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office. All I have to say about Leah Askey is, good fucking riddance, you belong in prison. Next up on the naughty list is Judge Chris Kunze Minnemeyer, the judge from Russ Faria's original trial. She's the one who didn't allow any evidence into the trial that dealt with Pam or anything that went against police or the original investigators. She's the one who wouldn't allow any evidence regarding Pam Hupp, the insurance beneficiary change. And don't forget, she repeatedly allowed the prosecution to regularly do whatever it pleased, with zero regard for established rules and tradition. Well, in January of 2017, the Missouri Supreme Court ordered Judge Minnemeyer to serve a 6-month unpaid suspension for violating judicial misconduct rules. A complaint had been filed in 2014 by the director of the Missouri State Public Defender System, alleging that she was waiting to assign public defenders to cases until after the deadline for requesting a new judge in a case. Judge Minnemeyer also threatened to file complaints against public defenders if they attempted to represent defendants before they had been assigned to the case. Her suspension began on February 1st of 2017. And this is directly from the Washington Times. The dispute was over a Missouri law dictating when a public defender can appear in court or file on behalf of a defendant charged with a probation violation. Minnemeyer argued that no public defenders can represent a client before they are appointed by the court. After a request for a meeting with Minnemeyer to settle the disagreement was ignored, the public defender's office filed a complaint with the Missouri Judiciary's Commission on Retirement, Removal, and Discipline. The commission found that in all of the cases with a delayed appointment, the defendant had no money or valuable assets, and Minnemeyer had violated the Judicial Code of Ethics. Missouri Supreme Court Judge Paul C. Wilson wrote on a concurring opinion that Minnemeyer, quote, purposely subverted the rights of some defendants in her feud with a public defender and was therefore in violation of judicial ethics. Chris Coons and Minnemeyer also had 4 cases reversed by the appeals court and was suspended without pay. And that's it for part 1 of the Pam Hupp series, guys. This covers Betsy Faria's murder, Russ Faria being convicted, charged and convicted of that murder, going to prison, as well as that conviction being overturned. What happened next? And this is the reason why NBC is starting a show called The Thing About Pam and, you know, casting Renee Zellweger, Judy Greer, and others. Because this is where it gets so crazy, when the full case, the full breadth, the full craziness of Pam Hupp is finally unmasked and is made public. So this is part 1. Join us. Part 2 will be available over the weekend. But yeah, get up to date on the Pam Hupp case by Joel Schwartz's book, Bone Deep. Learn about this case from the defense attorney's perspective. And then March 8th, guys, we are going to group watch The Thing About Pam. But this is part 1 of the Pam Hupp series. Part 2 will be out on Saturday. And yeah, thanks for listening, guys. I'm Robin. This is We Saw the Devil. If you're liking the show, loving the show, follow us on social media. You can find us everywhere at We Saw the Devil. If you want to financially back the show, you can do so at Patreon. Other than that, until next crime.